back to the beginning. This webinar is ductless heat pumps, recent research applications for low energy homes, part two. This webinar series is brought to you by PG&E's Energy Training Center. We've got Mark Jerome from CAM Energy in Roseburg, Oregon, Bob Davis from Ecotope, Portland, Oregon, and Mark Rosenbaum from South Mountain Company on Martha's Vineyard here as discussants and responders to questions. I'm Linda Wigington from Affordable Comfort, Inc., and I'm facilitating, now that you can hear me, I'm facilitating this discussion. Wanted to make the standard disclaimer, the views of Mark, and myself and Bob do not represent PG&E. They are our opinions and our perspective and knowledge. This webinar is going to be led by questions that were sent in and received. You can still send questions to me via email. Don't know if we'll get to them. We've got quite a list. Do put in the subject line questions. Make it very, very clear. One thing I'd like to say just in context is this webinar is part of the 1,000 Home Challenge, and so that's the context for this call. The context of the 1,000 Home Challenge is deep energy reductions, deep being defined as a 70 to 90% reduction in site household energy use, annual energy use, which means we're looking at very ambitious goals as either an immediate one-year or several-year effort or a phased effort. So part of the context that we'll be discussing is with the role of ductless heat pumps for projects that are planned to meet the 1,000 Home Challenge. The primary focus of this webinar are single-head systems and in a heating mode. That's primarily because that's the experience in terms of research results that we have. They were summarized on Tuesday by Bob and also by Mark Jerome in terms of experience, incredibly valuable experience coming out of the Pacific Northwest. We will be addressing cooling applications and some other systems as well in this call. I'd like Mark, Bob, and Mark to each introduce themselves and sort of make a summary statement from Tuesday. So, Oregon, Mark, why don't you go first?
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm Mark Jerome, owner of CAM Energy. I work part-time doing consulting, education, quality assurance for utility programs, concentrating on HVAC-related issues. And my experience is I still work part-time with Pacific Air Comfort in Roseburg, Oregon, installing, servicing, maintaining HVAC systems with a number of installs under my belt, probably in the neighborhood of around 300 or more, and I have also participated in the Monmouth project, which is the pilot project that Bonneville had here as far as installing and commissioning those units. So been doing it for a while. I've been a technician for 28 years plus. So.
And what are the couple of key points you'd like for those as a summary of what you said Tuesday?
I believe that ductless heat pumps have their applications in tight homes and in the Pacific Northwest where we have low electricity rates. I think they're a great heating and cooling device for most applications where we have high fuel costs. So they've been a very valuable comfort device for the contractor's point of view.
Great. Thank you. Bob. Bob? Not
here.
Yeah,
I don't see Bob on the as identified as a host. He may have called in as a participant.
Mark, we'll catch up and find Bob. Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Mark Rosenbaum. I'm a building geek. Spent most of my working life in New Hampshire. I'm now in Massachusetts, and I'm interested in heat pumps because I'm interested in net export or zero energy buildings, and I've been working as a consultant on buildings that are deep energy retrofits. Some of the early 1,000 Home Challenge projects are ones that I participated in. I'm a passive house consultant, so I'm really looking at, and a trainer for that program, so I'm really looking at very low load buildings as well as just moderate and low load buildings. And pretty much we've almost done nothing that hasn't been a large enough building or campus, I guess I'd say, to have distributed biomass district systems in the last few years that hasn't been mini split heat pump based. And that's after a fair amount of experience at multiple scales with ground source heat pumps, which I hope that I am done with for the rest of my career.
Okay. I think Bob's probably on the phone but got muted. I'm going to unmute in order to get back and pick Bob up. So, Bob Davis, are you on the line?
Yes, yeah, sorry about that. I was double-checking what code I used to call in with, but you can give me the other one at the end of my introduction. I'll call back in if you want to do it that way.
Okay, right now, could you just dial
yes.
star six?
Sure. There we go. Yeah, I got muted again.
Okay.
So I'll just introduce myself and then just ship me the other code and I can call back in on the email or tell me what it is. Bob Davis from Ecotope. We're located in Portland, also in Seattle. We are primarily a research company, but we also do a lot of design work, another part of our office. And our focus for 35 years has been residential research, largely in support of the energy code development process in the Pacific Northwest. The focus we had originally was more on whole building simulation, and it shifted to ducts and mechanical ventilation, moved more heavily into heat pumps and commercial rooftop package units, and now we are, I guess, becoming experts on ductless heat pumps because we've measured the performance of them now in about 140 sites. We have a year and a half of data on about 95 of them in single-family homes, which is the nucleus of the presentation from Tuesday. And in the Northwest, the primary interest we have is the amount of electric resistance. There's a bunch of technological interferences came through, but our interest in the Northwest is in seeing how much heating energy, because we have lots of electric resistance, can be offset by using a ductless heat pump.
Again, I'm on a conference call.
Great, thank you. First question is primarily oriented, initially at least, to Mark, and this is within the context of low-load homes. And one of the things I wanted to mention is we do have folks from all over North America on the call, including some folks from UConn and pretty cold climates. So the issue of could you first address, Mark, the issue of how you define a low-load home considering the wide range of climates and house sizes and house types?
Do you want to distinguish about which Mark you want as you go through this?
Good idea. I'm calling Mark Jerome Oregon Mark, so if I don't say Oregon Mark, it's you.
Okay, thank you. I guess numerically, the way I look at this is a design load of 10 BTUs per hour per square foot or less.
How you doing?
So that crosses climates, and that's a darn good house in Duluth, and you'd think you'd have to work awfully hard in most of California to do worse than that, but I imagine that people putting their minds to it can do that.
Well, do the math for me. If you have a 1,200-square-foot house, then?
It's 12,000 BTUs an hour design load.
Okay. And, okay, so.
Now, I think the thing that's important to add to that, when you're talking about a heat pump, particularly when you're talking about an air source heat pump that's pulling heat out of the outdoor air, is that the ratings of these units drop as the outdoor air temperature drops. So there's a secondary thing that you need to get clear on for your climate about where in the temperature range you're looking at the rating for the heat pump. So the standard way that we've rated heat pumps for a long time in this country is you'll get a rating at 47 degrees and a rating at 17 degrees. And, you know, if you're in Southern California, looking at the rating at 47 gets you close. And if you're in most of New England where I work, we're looking at the 17 rating, and then we're actually trying to get from the manufacturer's ratings at more around 0.5 degrees. So that's the important thing. Once you define low load, you have to understand whether to handle a house, you know, that 1,200 square foot house that you mentioned, Linda, at 1,200 square feet, it's 12,000 BTUs an hour. And if it's in San Diego, maybe that is a one-ton unit. But if you're in Boston, that might be a 1.5-ton unit, depending on the product. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The one question in addition to that, though, would be, let's say you've got a small apartment. The small apartment in San Francisco, for example, 600 square feet, that design load would be fairly stringent, and yet, if you had a 2,000 square foot house that met your criteria in New Hampshire, you're really talking about two buildings at the same system. I guess what I'm trying to say is isn't a bigger issue when you think about a 1 or 1.5 ton ductless heat pump, whether or not that would meet the load of that building as a building, not just on a per square foot basis.
Yes. And I think that one of the great things about these things is how deeply they modulate. So, you know, the smallest unit you can get that I'm aware of, and other folks may know differently, has a cooling load rating of 9,000 BTUs an hour, so it probably has a heating rating of close to 10,000. But that unit will modulate down to probably 25% and then pretty much turn off. So that there isn't a big problem that I see, and Mark Jerome could comment on this from his field experience, but we're not hearing complaints or seeing, you know, unexpected energy uses from projects where we're installing multi-head systems that are oversized, you know, each head is oversized for the space that it's actually in. We're not seeing that as being a problem. So if that San Francisco apartment was had a design load of 6,000 and therefore a typical winter load of 2,000 or 2,500, it wouldn't be worrisome to me, based on my experience, putting that single head 9,000 BTU an hour unit in there.
Okay. Bob or Oregon, Mark, you want to add anything? What we're talking about is the idea of what would be the criteria for a home in which a ductless heat pump could meet the primary heating load.
Yeah, I think Mark describes it very well. And actually, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. That's a relief. The issue, too, is that it's very important to check the output tables for a specific ductless heat pump in the colder bins. If they don't exist, that's a good sign that you maybe shouldn't specify that one in Duluth. There's an interesting parallel as well to what Mark had mentioned about nominal ratings at the cold temperature bins. A similar effect occurs with ground source heat pumps where, you know, when we size ground source systems, which we do, sorry, Mark, we occasionally still do, but when we specify them, we use an entering water temperature of 30 degrees. And if you live in the southern tier of the country where your groundwater or ground temperature is in the 50s or 60s or warmer, you don't have to worry so much. If you have a nominal 6-ton heat pump, say for a big house, you're going to get 6 tons or pretty close to it when the ground's that warm. In the northern tier, though, your 6-ton heat pump becomes a 3.5-ton heat pump. And then if you have ducts on top of it that aren't very carefully designed, then you have maybe a 3-ton or 2.5-ton heat pump by the time you're all said and done. So you have to really check the fine print and be honest with yourself in the northern tier as far as which system to put in and what to expect from it.
And a point that was made on Tuesday was that what you saw of the systems you looked at, that the manufacturer's data was accurate and the lower temperature, correct, Bob?
For selected models.
Okay. And that's the newer models. Can you just quickly summarize the models that you tested?
Well, because we're very interested in promoting and continuing to promote systems which will work in colder places, the models that we focused on, Fujitsu and Mitsubishi, the RLS series for Fujitsu and the what's called the FE series or Hyperheat series for Mitsubishi, and we did not. You know, we had limited resources to look at all the different models, but we found that at least those model series were effective down in, you know, single or teen digit or even below zero conditions in some cases, or most cases we looked at. So for our purposes, systems that are maintaining, you know, 50 or 60 or even 70 or even more percent of their full nominal capacity when it's very cold outside are very important. Those systems also are operating with COPs of, well, it varies, but around 2, meaning you're still 200% efficient even when it's, you know, 5 degrees outside. And that sounds like a ridiculous claim, but when you've actually measured it and measured it repeatedly, you start to believe it. And also in the lab testing at Purdue, which we were overseeing, we had the same result. So it appears to actually do what it says it will do when it's very cold outside, those two models.
Okay.
And it might, Linda, be worth adding that the Hyperheat that Bob is speaking about, those products are designed and rated down to 13 below Fahrenheit.
Right.
So
and
we saw
one running at 16 below, and it was still doing a pretty good job. So.
Right. And I had 8,000 square feet of school in New Hampshire working off of the three-phase version of the Hyperheat at 22 below. So what we're seeing is, and if you talk to Mitsubishi, I don't know if this is true about the FE series, but the larger ones don't shut off till 31 below. So those products are particularly aimed and use a somewhat different internal technology, whereas I think what Bob has seen is the same thing that what Bob has tested is the same thing that we have seen anecdotally, which is the units that you can't even get a rating from the manufacturer. Some of these units are still running at 10 or 15 below, even though there's no rating, and putting out heat.
And that's a significant change from what we've had in the last few years, from what I understand, correct? Better performance at low temperatures.
Yes.
As we propose these for larger projects, you know, if we're proposing these for a large energy retrofit, like of a mill building would be to change a mill building into 100 units of affordable housing, we're often running into a situation that on projects that have either financing or something having to do with the government, I think that everybody now is probably unmuted because we keep hearing all that background stuff. They may be government requirements to have like a peer review. And the peer review people are often older engineers that do that work. And we have universally gotten reviews that say that air source heat pumps don't work in, you know, these climates.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, yes.
Yes, okay. I can hear you.
Good. We shouldn't hear the background noise. The question would be, when then would it be, aside from the issue of the heat loss from the space and the system having the output in order to consider one or two single head units, what would be the criteria for choosing a ductless heat pump over other systems?
So again, this is Mark Rosenbaum. I think some of the experience that we've had that might be pertinent here is at South Mountain, we've done a bunch of single-family affordable housing in the last few years that are 8 or 10 houses at a time. And these are 2 or 3-bedroom, fairly tightly massed. They're usually sort of cape-style buildings. And if they're a 3-bedroom, they have a first-floor bedroom as an L. And we did a batch three or four years ago that were substantially better than your average construction. They were 2x6s with 2 inches of polyiso on the outside and maybe 300 or 400 CFM 50 kind of buildings. And we put single point heaters in that were through the wall sealed combustion gas heaters, were NIES. Now, those units, I think this is a key point for distribution in this kind of discussion of single point sources. Those units make hotter air than heat pumps. Nonetheless, we found that the different ways that people ran their homes gave very different results in terms of the owner's satisfaction. So someone that ran the space that the heater was actually in, which is typically a fairly open plan kitchen, dining, living area, and they ran that space at 70, 71, and they had their doors to the bedrooms open most of the time, would have experienced bedroom temperatures like 68. You know, we did some hobo data logging of this. We had one client who was complaining bitterly about her house, and we data logged it over a two-week period in January, and she never ran the living room above 60, and she was surprised that her bedrooms weren't warm. So to me, there's a managing expectations thing that's really key here when you're doing spec housing or some kind of, when you're working where you don't know who's going to be the end user. We built, a year ago, we had occupied 8 homes that use a single point source mini split in the kitchen, dining, living room. And because of our experience with the previous buildings, we put radiant electric ceiling panels in the bedrooms on a separate thermostat. So each bedroom is a zone. And we are sub-metering. We have now a year's worth of data. We'll have a year's worth of data June 1st. And we have sub-metered those homes. So we have the energy into the heat pumps, the energy into the radiant heaters, and the energy into the PVs. Two of them are net zero. And what's fascinating is the different mix as you go from household to household over such a small sample, only 8 homes, in how much energy people are using in that electric radiant zonal heat. And I think it maps onto what Bob Davis and Ecotope have found in the retrofit in the project that they've been studying. It goes so much back to occupant behavior. So we've gotten nervous here as essentially designers, builders, and developers of affordable housing. When we don't know the client and we're doing 8 or 10 homes, we've gotten nervous about not providing heat in a remote room. As a matter of fact, we data logged 6 points in 4 of those homes this past winter in concert with Ibicus. And we actually saw cases where the first floor bedroom got colder than the basement. So it's a very well-insulated basement. It's an R20 foam all the way around basement. But with no heat and literally no parasitic heat. The only thing down the basement that makes heat is an electric water heater, which is a Marathon, so extremely well-insulated water heater. There's no heat in the basement. The basement kind of bottoms out here on Martha's Vineyard at 59 or 60 without any heat. And no insulation in the floor above, so it's connected to the house. And we literally saw, in some cases, coldest weather, the bedrooms getting colder. And that's people who kept the doors to the bedroom closed and didn't use the zonal heating there.
And that was by choice.
That's by choice. Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned in our offline conversation, speaking about the experts meeting that happened in Boston after the Building Energy Conference, with a 3 Building America teams and a bunch of us civilians that were speaking about our experience in very low load buildings and simplified heating and cooling systems. And the dominant thing that I walked away from that day with is congruent completely with our own experience here, which is that the occupants defeat the best intentions no matter what.
Defeat? or will do whatever they choose to do. And that,
well, in other words,
have technology
what I mean
match
is,
them.
What I mean is, you can do all the math you want and test cells you want. People will still run their homes in ways that you can't predict. And if you are in a position where you're responsible for their satisfaction at the end, you're taking a risk. If you don't know who they are ahead of time and you've managed their expectations, you're taking a risk because they can imagine a way to run the house where they'll be dissatisfied. And if you don't have some way of providing heat into a room that's remote from where a single point source of heat is, you can have unhappy people.
Mm-hmm. And I think that parallels the experience that Barbara Miller had with National Affordable Housing Network. They've been using point heating sources for years, recommending it, but they also recommend the ceiling radiant, fairly inexpensive cove heater, just so that people do have the option if they want to warm up a bedroom, they can warm up a bedroom up, you know, warmer than the average temperature of the house, for example.
Yes, and we saw over a sample size of 8 homes that I think we have one home where people have put more kilowatt hours into the radiant panels than the heat pump, and at the other end of the spectrum we have a home where they've hardly touched the radiant panels. And in the 4 homes that Ibicus cooperated with us to monitor with the hobos, I think that they had broader temperature ranges, and typically they're defining it as how many hours you have within plus or minus 2 degrees of the main space where the heater is. And what was fascinating is I live in a house that's much lower standard construction than these 8 homes. I mean, these 8 homes are passive house tight. They're all fiberglass windows with triple glazing, 2 lowy layers. They're 9.5-inch double stud walls. I mean, they're really, really good houses. They're homes with loads not much more than 10,000 BTUs an hour. I live in a 2x6 house that was built in 2000, not nearly as good an envelope, and put a Fujitsu 12 RLS, which is one of the ones that Ecotope has monitored extensively, in the open space on the lower level, the main level, and have 2 bedrooms and a bath upstairs. And with the bedroom doors open and not nearly as good an envelope, double glazing, we experienced in the coldest weather that the upstairs was 4 degrees colder, the bedrooms, and in more typical winter weather where it might be like 30 degrees Fahrenheit outdoors, they were 2 degrees colder. So we had more even temperatures than the super insulated houses. By basically leaving, by not messing much with the thermostat on the unit.
By leaving it steady.
Yeah, I mean, what we learned early on, we turned off our oil boiler and put the Fujitsu in and started it up right after the day after Christmas. And what we learned pretty early, and Bob and Mark, I'm very interested in your experience about this, is that we didn't make any savings with deep setbacks. So if we set back at 62 and then set up at 70 when we were there, because of the distance between the set point and the room temperature, the unit kicks on to high, where it's working less efficiently. So I wasn't seeing, since I was looking, I've got just a regular kilowatt-hour meter on the energy input to the Fujitsu. I wasn't seeing a difference in my daily kilowatt-hours with the deep setback. So after a couple of weeks, you know, that's how we ran it with the boiler. After a couple of weeks, we just, if we weren't there or at night, we set it to 66, and when we were there, we set it at 70.
Mark and Oregon Mark and Bob, comments on what Mark said?
Yeah, this is Mark. I know that in the Bonneville DHP pilot that was put on in Monmouth, they found that they educated the homeowners to leave the doors open, and they found that rooms that had been shut off and the thermostats with the ceiling cable or baseboard had been shut off. Those rooms typically were in the wintertime here in Oregon running about 56 to 58 degrees. And once they put in the DHP in, they were instructed to leave the doors open and leave the thermostats where they had normally left them at, which was off. And room temperatures rose in all rooms, and the whole house felt more comfortable, according to the homeowners that were surveyed. So this basically says exactly what Mark was saying.
Okay. And yet if somebody wanted the lowest possible use, if they had it, it's possible to shut the doors and let the rest of the house cool further and have a warmer zone. Like if you were at a large house, you could use a ductless heat pump to create a warmer zone, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Oh, definitely.
Yep.
What's the recommendations regarding installing a ductless heat pump in terms of positioning on the wall, positioning with the house, if your goal is to get distributed comfort?
Yeah, typically what we've been advising people on the best practices webinars that we've been presenting here in the Northwest for the contractors is high on the wall. That way that can mix with the air in the room. Typical throws on these units are somewhere between 17 to 20 feet. So we get good mixing if they're high on the wall in a centrally located room, like a living room, family room, or so forth like that.
And what happens if you put that same unit in a smaller room? Does that just mean it's not going to be as comfortable because you don't get the mixing?
I think that you're kind of limiting your, like Mark said, the lowest unit that I think that you can buy is 9,000. I heard there's a 6,000 coming out, but I don't know if it's out on the market yet. But a 9,000 BTU room in Oregon, or a 9,000 BTU unit in a room in a bedroom in Oregon, a small bedroom, is kind of limiting the use of it. It's probably not a great place to put it unless you got a fairly large size living room or bedroom.
Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, I don't think I could add much. We should probably keep moving because there's a lot of other questions.
In terms of comfort, have there been other studies or field measured data on actual temperatures and the effects? Or would Mark Rosenbaum, you just suggest people tune in and look at the presentations that were done at the expert meeting? I think they are going to be posted soon, and there are some already posted on Building Science Corps website.
Well, I think one of the interesting things was the experiment that Rob Aldridge from Stephen Winters did in the Wisdom Way homes in Greenfield, Mass., which are also through-the-wall sealed combustion gas units. And he used a little Panasonic fan in the same room with the heater in the ceiling to transfer, I think, 30 CFM roughly to each bedroom. And what he found was it was scavenging air off the ceiling at 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than the room, actual room, you know, set point temperature, middle of the room. After that meeting, I did some data logging in my own house with the Fujitsu in that space, and there just isn't any stratification worth harvesting. You know, from the middle of the room to the absolute ceiling, but now I'm 10 feet away from the unit. It was well under a degree difference.
So very uniform temperatures in the space.
Yeah, I found the space temperature to be very uniform.
But is there still an option of, you're saying without the temperature difference, it doesn't make sense to try to pull the air between rooms as much?
I think the benefit of what Rob did is depreciated when you don't have extra delta T to work with. I think the thing that his experiment has made me think about the most is, and tell me if this gets too arcane for this discussion, is that what we typically are doing is we're using heat recovery ventilation. So now I'm talking about, again, new housing or significant retrofits. And particularly on our affordable houses, we've really worked very hard to get those systems down to the absolute minimum cost we can, which means we're using very small units and running them continuously. So, for instance, the Fantech 704 series. And those units do not have a high, they're very electrically efficient. They use about 30 watts, but they don't have a high thermal effectiveness. So they're, let's say, delivering air at, when it's really cold out, at 50 degrees here. And so now I've got a stream of air going into the bedroom that doesn't have a heater, theoretically, at, 15 or 20 degrees colder than my desired set point. And I've imposed the heating load from my ventilation system. So what Rob was doing is dumping all his ventilation, fresh air, in the same room with the heater, and then pulling that air out and delivering it to the bedrooms. And so instead of a small air stream that imposes an actual heating load, he had a small air stream that was imposing a heating source plus the fresh air. And I thought that was clever, but I've recognized from my own measurements that I'm not going to have the same stratification and sort of extra temperature to really kind of boost that airstream into the remote rooms.
Okay. Let's jump down to some of the questions relating to installation considerations, particularly with a focus on single-head systems. And Oregon, Mark, I wondered if you could address just issues related to the location of the outside coil. We had the question of, does it matter what side of the house, whether it's north or south, in terms of exposure, does it make a difference if you put the outside coil in a slightly sunnier spot? It might be warmer.
It probably wouldn't matter much. The outside temperature is getting to the coils what really matters, and we don't have a whole lot of sun here in the northwest so in the winter. So here it's probably a little more trivial than it is in a place that gets a lot of sun. I think that you might reduce defrost energy by setting it in the sun, but I don't think that there's any real general knowledge that would tell you that you should put it on the north side or the south side, and I don't think that there's going to be a huge amount of energy impact, but I guess I'd have to defer to Bob for that.
Well, the question was also asked on cooling. On the cooling side, there is a belief that if the unit's in direct sun, that its efficiency will be affected. But these are air-cooled or air-heated units, depending on time of year. And Florida Solar did a study years ago in air conditioning where they shaded condensing units and found no difference between shaded and unshaded. The crucial issue is the temperature of the air going through the coil.
Okay.
On the heating side, the same applies, however. What I have seen in a couple instances in more severe parts of our region is more has to do with prevailing wind and snow drifting. And a couple instances, or one in particular, where a poor choice was made just in terms of how much, wind-driven snow and ice was being sent into the outdoor unit. And it was the only case where this seemed to be a problem amidst over a dozen other installations in Idaho Falls where things were working fine. It was more of an issue of the prevailing wind problem. That's not quite the same question, but it is something to keep in mind. That would also presumably be an issue for a larger split system unit, but in this case it's a fairly modest-sized outdoor unit.
And I know that the outside unit, because it's lighter weight, could also be mounted on a house. Is there advantage to mounting on a house or on a roof versus mounting on the ground?
There would be in that case.
Yeah, in McCall, Idaho, I put in two of the Mitsubishi Hyperheat units on Ken Eklund's home. And we put them up about 8 foot high.
Yeah.
On the side of the house.
Heavy snow area, often, 4 or 5 feet of snow in
ski area. Yeah.
And they don't weigh very much, so you can build a reasonable mounting bracket or use things that are relatively off the shelf. And
I believe the outdoor units weigh somewhere around 100 pounds, and indoor units probably more like 6 to 10 pounds.
So
you know,
no problem with mounting it high as long as you've got the airflow.
Right.
We mount,
Yeah. The clearances are very very minimal in with these DHPs. So we probably put them about 8 inches from the wall, and I've seen where some cases you can put them as close as 4 inches to the wall and still have adequate airflow across the coil.
And what about problems with the defrost water freezing under the unit or clearances
yes.
under?
Yes, that's been a problem. And in fact, at Ken's house in McCall, Idaho, we had that situation where we had a one of the two units was producing a little more defrost energy because it was being operated and the other unit wasn't. And a leaf got in the pan and had clogged the pan. So then that defrost had built up ice up under the coil and started causing capacity issues with that coil. So we're going to put in two defrost pan heaters. They're 23 watts. Into those units sometime in the near future, hopefully before next winter, to try to minimize that problem.
And would that 23-watt heater be on much?
Only during the defrost mode.
Okay, so fairly minimally.
Fairly minimal, yes.
A couple kilowatt hours a month or much more?
I would probably have to defer to Bob, I guess.
We haven't really digested the defrost part of our field study. We have some information from lab studies, and I haven't gone through to crunch it. It's surprisingly limited overall time for defrost, and the defrost cycles tend to be fairly quick because it's not a lot of mass that has to be. You know, the coils are relatively modest in surface area and so on versus the compressor capacities. It's not zero, but it tends to be. It looks to be a modest number, but another thing in this subject is that we have seen some installations where, because of the ground type around the outdoor unit, or the worst case scenario, which is one where they tell you all the time, don't ever do this, is to put the outdoor unit in a place where the water could freeze on a sidewalk, and it still happens even. You know, installers that have a limited number of places they can put it, and sometimes they make a bad choice. And so if you have well-drained ground around the thing and the water can drain off with or without a pan heater, that's one thing. But if you're limited on where you put it or where you decide to put it, that can create trouble. Go ahead.
What kinds of outdoor temperatures are you getting into issues with condensate and the defrost cycle? You know, how much of moderate climate would this be a factor for?
Not much. We're talking about we do include Idaho Falls, which is a 8,500 degree day climate in our because it's the Snake River drains into the Columbia. But that's this would apply in places like Duluth and probably even in places like Denver, Salt Lake City under certain circumstances where you have sustained cold temperatures. Another modification that we've made some cases is that the pans under these units don't always have drainage holes. And so we have power drills. Or some people go to the lengths of, putting additional drainage material out through them, but then that could freeze as well. This is really in places, more continental climates with more demanding winter conditions.
So in terms of most California weather, would the outdoor condensate be an issue at all?
Well, it would be in Truckee.
Right.
I said most.
Not most other spots, no.
Okay.
So
people who have to deal with this issue in other circumstances as far as, pipes freezing or water draining are fairly innovative in dealing with it. And this is one more thing that they would have to improvise or place, be very careful in placing the outdoor unit.
So one of the things that I think I've noticed on my own unit in a milder climate, although I think it would certainly cover a lot of Oregon and Washington and California here in Martha's Vineyard, is that the time when I actually see frost on the coil outside is when it's right around freezing, because there's high moisture content in the outdoor air. And so, you know, there's the more sophisticated the sensing process is about really whether it needs to defrost or not. And I suspect these things are pretty good at that. I don't notice it in the colder temperature. Now, that's anecdotal. But when I've actually noticed frost on the unit is when it's been not so cold and very moist outside.
Yeah, the grains of moisture in the colder bins really start to fall off. We did run some tests at Purdue on the 5-degree and 10-degree bins, and you can make ice for them, but that's in some ways with a chamber that probably has considerably higher RH than, or not RH, but absolute moisture in it than you would tend to see under most natural conditions. But yeah, in the Northwest, we have lots of weather between 30 and 40 degrees Fahrenheit outside, which is perfect ice making conditions when the coil is probably in the mid 20s or something like that Fahrenheit. So,
okay. So a pretty common condition then.
Mm-hmm.
But those conditions, the thing about those conditions is the reason I haven't noticed the kind of problem that you folks have also mentioned, which is the ice, the melt from the defrost freezing under the unit, is that it's not freezing. It's still liquid.
It's still liquid in most cases once the reverse cycle happens and the water runs off.
One thing I want to clarify regarding the whole issue of where ductless heat pumps could work as a primary system and its relationship to California is that it would seem like the issue isn't as much, Mark, one of not needing the full BTUs that the a 9 or 12,000 BTU output system puts in, but the perception that people need a lot more heat than they might actually need. We ran into this comment was made at a conference I was at just the other day. Some folks in Minnesota were saying, well, we're dealing with housing stock that's much colder than your housing stock here in California. By the time we weatherize these houses, we put in a 60,000 BTU heating system. And at their recent Affordable Comfort Conference, a lot of folks from outside of California were amazed that, you know, people are putting in 80,000 BTU furnaces and houses in the Bay Area where it's a very mild climate. So I would think that there'd be a major perception issue that you couldn't possibly get enough energy out of a ductless heat pump, even in a mild climate, because the houses are relatively uninsulated. So, Bob, you have comments on that based on the output of these systems, how they might work, and how the experience from your insulated, electrically heated housing stock in the Northwest would translate?
Well, we would characterize majority of the homes are, two-thirds, three-quarters of the homes in our study as at least, moderately to well insulated by national standards. You know, our 11 at least walls and our 30 in the lid probably in a insulated floor assembly and probably double glazed windows. And our experiment was to look at cases where you are using the ductless in the main part of the house and the back rooms still have electric resistance. And it's sort of similar to what Mark had described, but in a little different, more existing older homes versus, say, newer homes. But the main issue is how much, in that instance, how much of the main part of the house can be kept comfortable for how much of the year. And in a milder climate, such as most of California, My expectation would be that you could get acceptable comfort for large fractions of the heating season, at least in the main part of the house, with a we've been talking mostly about, one ton ductless heat pumps. There's a model series that's sort of 1.5 or 1+ ton. Those tend to have the highest efficiencies, but you can also get 2-ton or even slightly bigger indoor units, where the efficiencies do diminish somewhat, but those units have quite a bit more firepower, and we have seen some of those, not as many in our study, but there you can see things, say, in the Portland climate where, of 800, 900, even 1,000 square feet of space, because we have a big open floor plan, are kept quite comfortable for all conditions in the winter, even when we're down below freezing. Those systems have not received as much attention from consumers, primarily because the efficiencies, the rated efficiencies, are somewhat less than the one-ton units. And a main motivator for many consumers at this point, at least, is that the federal tax credit was applicable to the one-ton systems and not to the two-ton systems. Now, on an operating cost basis, if you can get, 800-900 square feet with a two-ton, whereas if you only had a one-ton, you might have to supplement with, say, plug-in heaters or something else, your operating costs are going to be less with the two-ton, even though the nominal efficiency is not as favorable as the one-ton. It also might be that if there's more demand for a slightly higher capacity product, manufacturers might respond with systems which do have improved efficiency. There's some coil geometries and so on which are involved there, which may be not be able to overcome by you may not be able to get all the way to what you have with one tons, but then on the other hand you might. So the market pull has really been for the smaller units so far, but we're just barely getting started in this country, and that could change.
Okay.
So something I would add to that, Bob, is Linda's question was, she mentioned, in San Francisco, people putting in 80,000 BTU an hour furnaces. And, when I moved into the house that we have here in Martha's Vineyard, I was living for the first time in my adult life with a boiler. And I did a bunch of data logging of the boiler. And in a fairly low load house, because I think this would qualify and be similar to a lot of Pacific Northwest and California homes, what I found was the boiler is so oversized that its effective efficiency was much poorer than the AFUE rating. And in fact, when I got the heat pump up and running, I was data logging the boiler, just making hot water in the indirect tank. And here's this German boiler. It's a Bederus. It's got a stainless steel high zoot external indirect tank, and the system efficiency that I calculate from my measurements is like 15%. The other issue that I noted is over the first two winter months that I had the Fujitsu operating, which was from Christmas to 2 months later in February, the system was using an average of 12 kilowatt hours a day, which here for fairly high electric rates is about $2.15. The oil usage up to that point before I switched was 2.5 to 3 gallons a day. So you're talking about $10 or $12 a day versus a little over $2 a day. And then the last thing is that people rarely speak about is that boiler, and I think this would be worse for a furnace because of the blower power versus pump power, but that boiler between its burner and the circulating pump and the controls was using at least 3 kilowatt hours a day. So when the boiler got turned off and replaced by the heat pump, through the winter, a quarter of the energy that the heat pump used is essentially energy that was used as a parasitic energy input to the oil-fired heating system.
Yeah. People tend to take things for granted or think you have to keep doing them the same because that's the way you've always done them. There's a fraction of especially the installation design community which will never believe this can work. This being a inverter-driven compressor as a primary, heating device. A similar thing is going on now with water heating. Although heat pump water heaters in various forms have been around for a long time, but The ductless heat pump is new and it's different, it's not for everybody. And again, it's just barely getting started. It certainly has put fear into the hearts of domestic equipment manufacturers, especially those that need ducts to distribute heat or cooling into a home. And they should rightfully be frightened at this point.
Yeah, they're trying their best to try to adapt by trying to incorporate an inverter-driven compressor into a ducted system, which I really think is going to be a lemon, but I guess we'll find out later on that one. So.
And the key thing is to use rated performance, but use it when, but understand how to use it. Obviously, I think Bob, you made the comment that there weren't many times that you found good agreement between manufacturer's data and the field, the actual lab data of independent.
Well, no, actually, the reverse. At least
no, in this case, you said it was the reverse. It was very good.
Oh, yes, sorry, Linda. Yes, you're correct. We typically are not expecting to find that agreement, but here it's been remarkably good.
So the question is, what does somebody look at in terms of the data? You've got SEER, you've got SHPF, you've got ARRI, you've got other stuff. What would you look at in order to try to determine a system that might be very appropriate for a mild climate, which you don't care if you've got that, you know, 0 degree weather performance versus one in a cooler climate?
Boy, I don't have a an easy to use prescriptive method developed quite yet. I guess my general approach in buying heating and cooling appliances is don't buy the cheapest one. And that's true of other things, but we started at one side or one place a few years ago with the equipment that was sort of out there and have focused on at least our detailed metering on a fraction of what's out there and have discovered some what appears to be very reliable equipment capacity and efficiency-wise. And so I have no inclination to deviate from those products at this point if I were installing one in my home or recommending to someone else which one to install. We've almost completely talked about heating here. Cooling, well, I'm not the person to ask about that, especially when it comes to latent loads, because I haven't really looked at it. And in certain, many parts of the country, that's going to be the more important issue. And others will have to do that research in places that have latent loads. But as Mark Rosom stated earlier, the kind of confounding aspect of this technology is, whereas we typically have focused on peak heating conditions or the design conditions, you know, it's very cold outside. When it's very mild outside, whether you're in Santa Barbara or Duluth, the device will really gear down, running the part load. That's where we start seeing COPs of 4 or 5, even higher. And so the more that it runs in the part load, the more, you know, the higher your efficiencies go, the more unbelievable it is when you look at your electricity bill, like, is this thing even running? It's, you know, the thing's only using maybe a couple hundred watts or even less and still providing a fair amount of heat. So you have a lot more flexibility on use of the system over a wider range of conditions. Probably there is a price advantage up front to getting certain models versus others of some numbers of hundreds of dollars or maybe a little more. But I don't know. I don't have a good enough feel quite yet to make those comparisons and say, yes, if you were to save $500 to $1,000 at first cost, say in a milder place, that would pay off over the life of the equipment versus getting a system which probably does cost more, but which will work more reliably in the more demanding heating climates over many years.
Well, how does a person make the decision between putting in several units versus putting in one unit with multiple heads?
Well, I think someone asked this question. It's a good question. Our economics we presented in the first presentation was really, well, we're looking for a conservation measure which utilities can offer here, and we have a pretty good sense of what the savings are, at least when we've identified sites which do really use electricity for heat. We also know what the installation cost is for one-to-one or one outdoor, one indoor unit. you get the biggest savings in that first jump because you're looking at the main part of the house. After that, you keep adding units. Not in every case, but in most cases, for at least simpler homes, you're picking up smaller parts of the house, smaller heating loads, but the cost to add each successive unit is very similar to the cost of the first one. You don't get a volume discount, at least not yet, or not a meaningful one for these smaller zones. So the savings are smaller, the cost per zone is the same, so the economics start to fall off, the program design, you would not want to encourage people to do multi-zone systems because the economics would not work. There are other reasons for people to want multiple systems, mostly comfort, and that's fine, but policy-wise, it's unwise to incentivize people to do that. And again, this is all heating related. If you offer incentives in places that mostly encourage people to add cooling where they didn't have it before, which has happened to some degree in the Northwest, that is also not a very sound policy move. But that's, we have a limited cooling climate. You have to look at what the prevailing loads are, what the load is that you think you're going to now meet more efficiently with a ductless heat pump, and decide accordingly if you're, say, a utility or that's trying to incentivize energy conservation. People get these devices for different reasons, but if you're really looking at conservation, then you have to be careful about those issues.
So in terms of somebody looking at this from a project perspective where they're not, don't have a utility or policy framework and they want to make sure that a house is going to be comfortable and energy use as reasonable as possible, how would you make the decision? And maybe Oregon Bob, you answer this from your perspective. What would be the recommendation of having a multi-head system with two indoor or two or more indoor units versus completely separate systems?
Well, I can't say, Linda, that there is that much of a functional difference between the multis or one-to-ones and the cost differential, at least in Market Comet, seems to be fairly small now. I guess if I were doing it myself or advising someone else, I would look fairly carefully at what I thought the loads were that would be served by these devices and look at the expected capacities of the equipment in question, at least start there. It gets a little difficult to do, though, because you have to figure out where what the load is. If you have exposed walls and ceiling and floor and all that and windows, well, you can define that part pretty well. The problem is at some point back in there you get to an adiabatic place where, the other parts of the load sort of tails off and something else is going to pick up the rest of it. The question is, where is that point? Everyone who's now trying to figure this out has different answers, and people say, well, how do you size these things? And I say, I don't know. How far back in do you want it to be comfortable? Do you have any other heating sources or cooling sources? It's not as easy to size these as it is to size a furnace because of that nebulous point where there's not a load. No one really knows unless they decide they're going to put in a six-head system to take the place of whatever was in the house before. And then you're spending $20,000.
Which means it doesn't make as much sense.
Linda, I have some perspective on that from
please,
someone
please, help
doing
me.
new construction or deep energy retrofit. So we're not in a situation of being a utility, and we're not in a situation of doing a job so far, really, where we're putting them in to work in concert with an existing system. We're doing enough to the house that the existing system usually ends up being grossly oversized. It's fossil fuel driven, and there's all the usual reasons for getting rid of it, particularly here in Martha's Vineyard or most of rural New England where I've worked over the past 30-something years where there isn't natural gas. So the competing fuels are fossil fuels that are propane and oil. And at the moment, even if those systems work at their advertised efficiency, we're spending less than half the dollars per BTU delivered on the heat pumps. So typically, what we see in modest size homes is we're either making a decision to use a single point system, and then we are usually going with the less expensive electric radiant panels, or we're doing a multi-head system. And so on a three-bedroom house, it's either going to be a single-head system or typically a four-head system. And the single-head system is going to cost us about $4,000 if it's a simple install, and the four-head system is going to cost us around $9,000. And in terms of, market appreciation, people like seeing the four-head. And so, you know, we built a spec house this year, and we put four-heads, but all our affordable housing units have single heads, and they're essentially the same house. We made the spec house a little bigger and a little more luxurious, but it's basically the same house. The most interesting thing that I've seen on cost has been in one case where we did a deep energy retrofit on a house that isn't that uncommon, a type here in Martha's Vineyard, and maybe in California there are places that are like this, where it started off being a very small house, sort of a camp, and then gradually, as owners cycled through, there were a bunch of additions. And there's probably more foundation types in this one house than would be in a manual on how to design them. And it was really, really challenging to run any ducts in this building. So we ended up with, and people might laugh, but 7 zones of heating and cooling with wall cassettes. At the same time, we did a new house that was a little smaller, similar envelope, very, very high-grade envelope, and it basically was a ranch. It doesn't look like a ranch from the road, but basically it's a single-floor house with a basement. That house is a 2-zone ducted system. So they're concealed ducted units, and as people have noticed, many of the ones that are offered, although not all to be sure, are fairly low static pressure. So they're not going to drive a conventional whole house duct system. But they're small amounts of air compared to a high load house. What we found was that we're paying the same for that 2-zone ducted system as a 7-zone wall cassette system. So really the what we're finding is we can give people a lot of zones for less money than we can give them ducts. And typically, one of the biggest choice points that happen is whether people are willing to look at a wall cassette as opposed to having the whole thing hidden. And here in the Northeast, people are used to looking at radiators and fin tube radiation and all kinds of stuff, but you put a wall cassette on the wall for a heat pump, and all of a sudden you'd think that the end of the world has happened. Well, I guess it did happen, right? That was last week.
Yeah, well, we got about 5 months left.
Oh, okay, we got an extension?
Revised, yeah.
It depends who you talk to.
It's sort of like the IRS.
So, but a day is worth 1,000 years, maybe, so maybe we have 150,000 years left. I don't know.
Oh, is that metric?
Yeah.
So the last thing I'll say about these kind of choices is that if we can believe the AHRI ratings, which I am less and less confident about as the systems get more complex. So the VRF ratings, I don't know if they've been updated, but the true variable refrigerant machines that start at typically around 3 tons, like the Mitsubishi City Multi S series, for instance, those machines, when we first saw ratings on them, had HSPFs of under 8. And if you looked at the manufacturer's literature about input-output over the whole bin range, it looked like their HSPFs would probably be 10. So, first of all, you have to decide.
Can you explain which way is good?
Well, higher number. I mean, basically, it's a COP multiplied by the ratio of BTUs per hour per watt, 3.4.
Yeah.
And so one of the things you will notice is that the very highest performers, and I think Ecotope's work shows this so well, are the, in terms of the highest efficiency machines, are these single point machines. So the choice that we've made, and this, you know, all this could be questioned by you know, these are just judgment calls. The choice that we've made is that if we really have a two-zone system that's going to be wall-mounted, we're using two single-point systems because the lowest efficiency point of the market right now, and as Bob says, this will shift because we don't get all the machines that they make over in Japan here. But this, the lowest efficiency, the trough in the market, is the two-port multi-port systems. And so we'd rather put in two systems like the Fujitsu with an HSPF of 12 than put in a two-head, for instance, Mitsubishi that has an HSPF of under 9.
Right. That's
and we'll pay about the same. We might pay a little bit less for the two-head system, but not a lot.
Yeah, we've seen big variation of people reporting costs, so it's very, very important to talk to a variety of contractors and see what costs and make sure they're trained, as Oregon Mark stressed on Tuesday. But Oregon Mark, going back to you, what would your recommendations be if somebody wanted to use a ductless heat pump with a central system that's already operating? So we've got a central heating system. It does work. It's a big house, but it's heated with propane or oil. You know, it's going to cost $4,000 to heat next year, and you know they want to complement it. So, what would your recommendations be for how to make that work? And from what I understand, we don't really have any field data on this kind of application, other than anecdotal.
Right. We have just done a job like that for a friend of ours that's on the call, where. At a central forced air gas heating system, and we installed ductless mini split into the home to offset the cost of gas because our electricity is so much lower here in the Northwest, and it makes more sense to do electricity than gas here. And I advised her to either leave her thermostat off or set it at a lower set point than the ductless heat pump. And so that way the ductless heat pump will take the burden of the house. We leave doors open so that the rooms will get the heat from the ductless and not need as much as the of the gas as what she has used in the past. So, and that would pretty much go for about any type of house. To complement another system, use the ductless if it is a lower cost, of course.
So if you had the ductless heat pump as a heat source in the same space where the thermostat is, it's basically going to tell the thermostat that it doesn't need to run, correct?
Correct. So you set the ductless heat pump to be comfortable, 70 degrees, 68, whatever happens to be your comfort zone, and then take the other device and set it, 6-8 degrees colder, and that way, it's not going to run. And if for some reason, that person wants to have a little more heat down in that corner of the basement or over in that bedroom, something like that, they can bring on either the fan of the furnace alone, or to help circulate some of that air through that heating system without actually using the heat, or turn the heater on, turn it up for a few minutes, turn it back down.
Mm-hmm. And since most furnaces don't run along because they're oversized, it wouldn't take much to probably bring the temperature up.
Yeah, and I think maybe that there is the question that was might have been asking if there was a product which essentially integrated the ductless with, say, a gas furnace like a regular central split system heat pump or dual fuel application. That was my interpretation of the question, and the answer is no.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, the only thing that's anywhere close to that right now is the Daikin Altherma, but it's more of a water heating and radiant floor, radiant cooling type of unit.
It's a full bore system that looks to be quite impressive, and it's an outdoor, it's a split system that all the units are outdoors, or in it, at least the main. It's also in a different class in terms of price.
Yeah.
I wish I had one.
So what prices do they run?
I wish I had a Bentley too. About 20 grand.
Okay. Well, there are lots of people putting in systems that cost 20 grand nowadays.
Yeah.
It would be all unusual.
The Daikin Altherma is a neat. It's a neat, unique little system that doesn't have a whole lot of market appeal yet, and it doesn't have a whole lot of market use yet because it's such a narrow band that it can be used in as far as, you know, conventional stock, housing stocks.
But does it have then, you said it was could be hydronic? So, I mean, it could be tied into a different distribution?
Yes.
So
yes.
You could address your distribution barriers with it.
Yep.
Well, but wait a minute. It's important to recognize that unit makes a temperature lift of around 95 degrees.
Yep.
So outdoor temperature to the water temperature it makes. So
if you
have hydronic heating in California with radiant floors, then it's a great system if you can pay the freight to buy it. But if you've got hydronic heating that's been done with a boiler traditionally in the northern tier.
It probably won't work there.
It's not close to making boiler water temperature, so it's a very different application. And, you know, our view about that machine is that if you can save $10,000 plus on the install between, you know, multi-zone air-to-air versus the single-zone Altherma, because if you want to get zoning with the Altherma, you're probably going to go to either hydronic or you're going to have fan coils, and now you've got more money, and particularly if you've got radiant floors. So you're going to end up having all this money that you should have spent on better windows and a better building envelope. That when
you could buy an instantaneous gas wire here for a couple $1,000 installed and get most of what you wanted. If you want to do that, or maybe you already did. I don't know.
So one question came in with what were wall cassettes that Mark was referring to, and that's the indoor unit.
It mounts high up on the wall.
Yeah, I want to spend some last period on cooling applications and also some of the emerging or current options other than a one-to-one. But what would you say the biggest difference between heating and cooling is? Well, I mean, the question was the conclusion that the issue is that people are fine if the bedroom's a little cooler in the winter, but a hot bedroom in the summer is not acceptable to many people. So how do you address the issue that distribution is more important with in a cooling-dominated climate than a heating-dominated climate? Oregon, Mark, you want to take that one on?
Yeah. I think that in a cooling climate, if we don't have a tight home, it could be an issue. In a fairly loose home, distribution would definitely be an issue. So possibly some of the ductless systems might be a better answer, or a multi-head system that gets into some of those bedrooms. I'm sure that people care about the living room and the master bedroom, and they probably don't care what their kids sleep in rooms. You know, leave the doors open a little bit. They'll be fine. So, a multi-head system would probably be a better option unless we get extremely small bedrooms.
I would say that I completely agree with Mark, and my experience here, Linda, is smaller. But what we're doing, and I'm sad to say it, is that we had just a really, really hot summer here last summer, and so we're getting calls from our former clients. I mean, South Mountain's been here for 35 years, that have no cooling, that want cooling, and that process almost always has led us to not doing whole house cooling. We do the loads, we talk to them about the different prices, and of course retrofit costs more, but doing a retrofit of a wall cassette is not usually that huge a deal, and we haven't, I'm not sure yet if we've actually ended up cooling a whole house. And it's pretty much almost exactly on target to what Mark Jerome said. We do the master bedroom and we do the main living space.
Just take away the pain. Well, one experience, and we're getting a fair bit of awareness about Dave Robinson's experience. His website's Green Earth Equities, and he does the ducted, I think he's using the Fujitsu, with a very, very limited duct system, just sort of like the Building America kind of duct work, only in a drop down over the in the hallway. So not a traditional duct system whatsoever. And one of his websites, greenearthequities.com, he's got a wealth of information on there. He does a weekly webinar constantly with new information. But I'm sure that he would be more than happy to share what he knows. He didn't start off using the ductless heat pump, but I think he's got 10, 12. Judy, do you know many houses he's got done now?
I don't know the numbers, but he's using them on every house now, and he swears by them. And by the way, he puts the units on the roof, and he says that solves it, has all kinds of advantages in terms of debris and avoiding theft and vandalism and impact and that sort of thing. And the only downside is accessibility.
The other thing that his reason for doing it is sort of the situation that you referred to, Mark, at the very beginning. Is he wants a simple system, but he wants to be able to sell the house. He wants to be able to finance it, and he doesn't want a system that's going to be a barrier to somebody saying, oh, what, you know, you don't have heat in the bedrooms or cooling in the bedrooms. And he's in a climate that's very hot in the summer and got enough heating load in the winter that he wants to make sure that folks are going to be happy with the houses he's selling. So that system has worked very well for him in terms of dealing with the perceptions we have, which clearly are not ready in the conventional sense for a point heat source or cooling source being the only primary heating system in the house. Well, in terms of another question regarding cooling was whether or not you get the mixing that you'd want in a room. On the cooling side, obviously the mixing you need for cooling is different than heating. So, Oregon, Mark, what's your experience been in particularly some of the commercial buildings you deal with?
In some of the commercial buildings, we're seeing a lot more ducted systems, variable refrigerant flow. So they kind of fall under a different, range of homes. I mean, it's not a home, so it's not really doing the same thing. But in a typical home, the wall cassettes have a fairly decent throw. They're high on the wall. You can aim the vanes to point in a certain direction and to get the best mix in a room. So I think that I think in most any room that you would put a 9,000 or 12,000 BTU unit, unless it's a wall of glass, I think you're probably going to be okay with the mixing in a room.
And there were a couple questions regarding slide 88, and this is the slide, Bob, that you used in the presentation where you were talking about peak cooling, and you compared a ductless heat pump that was, I think, 1.5 tons with a 2 or 3 ton system. And the question was just really trying to clarify, it was one of your closing slides. Do you recall that comparison?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and the key there is that the ductless system, again, I'm still assuming a single indoor unit, which would keep, let's just make up a number, probably is reasonable, 500 square foot room comfortable. The rest of the house might not be comfortable. And so this is where it's difficult to make direct comparisons if you have a single indoor unit versus a central air conditioning system or heat pump, in air conditioning mode. This would represent a consumer, consumer choice here. So sort of like we talked about having a comfortable room in the heating season, this probably wouldn't work very – it would work even less well in the deep south with latent load issues. But it's just more to show that it depends on your audience and the expectations of the audience. 1,000 home people or others who are very much motivated by higher efficiencies might be more willing to sacrifice comfort, at least in some parts of the house. But that isn't going to work for everybody. As soon as you add more indoor units to improve comfort, especially in peak conditions, both the consumer economics and the consumer economics are going to change as well. People will pay a lot for convenience, though. But if you're adding ductless heat pump units mostly to get cooling, at least in large parts of the U.S., that's pretty much just a convenience. It isn't an energy conservation measure. But these days, there's way more air conditioning everywhere, cars, offices. Well over half or more like two-thirds of the homes being built in the Seattle area now, new homes have central air conditioning. 34 years ago, none of them did.
You know, I think it's worth adding that when you go to a ducted ductless heat pump system, you have an opportunity at least to specify a very efficient machine at a very low cooling load. So if you've got a house that really has a one-ton load, you can specify that machine, whereas with conventional equipment, you're not even close.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you think that would work better on the standpoint of reducing humidity because it would run more?
Should.
Oh, it should, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're just starting to learn more about all these systems, and the ones that use fan coils are a little harder to know going into residential. There isn't a lot of measured research yet on them, but chances are, especially if the ducts are kept inside, that any sort of nominal fall off versus the most efficient smaller cassettes will be, fairly modest. But again, we're just kind of at the beginning of being able to look at those systems and see what their annual usage might be. So I think there's some positive things there. It's just a matter of getting more experience with them.
Well, we're out of time. I wanted to close with you guys making a suggestion. If you could call the shots on a research project or a field research that would deal with understanding the role of ductless heat pumps in a California climate as part of figuring out how to get to 40% reductions in residential energy use by 2020. What would that research project be? Then I'll speak at once.
Well, I guess I would focus more on the cooling side and look at it in the more demanding cooling climates, and maybe do some experiments with Mr. Robinson's been doing, see how those systems work as far as usage and efficient and comfort go. It's a shame there isn't much in the way of latent load, although I think, Sacramento has a little bit, others have a little bit, but that's their limitations. But I think more of a cooling focus would be helpful.
And we certainly lack that data, particularly in
mm-hmm.
existing homes, having that
yep.
understanding. How about you, Oregon, Mark?
I was thinking right along the same lines as Bob, is trying to get a cooling-driven load, room by room temperature to make sure that we're seeing what room by room temperatures are. Single head and ducted systems would be something that I would like to see. So.
And the other Mark, what's your suggestion?
Boy, I think I'm going to answer it a different way. I guess if you're saying what should an organization with the clout that either the state of California or PG&E has to offer, I'd say let's bring in the stuff that they're making in Japan that we can't get here. So,
mm-hmm.
They're making CO2 refrigerant water heaters with COPs much higher than what we've got. They have a wider range of these units that are ducted down to small, quite small units, and it's been really difficult to get those. So it's really setting up a supply conduit, showing that there's the demand, looking at what's really available, what's actually made, and then looking at from that catalog of what's made, what's applicable here, what would be really useful here, and try to get that stuff here faster.
Get it here faster, maybe test the performance so we know how to fit it into the incentives and the models and all that.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank Mark, and Bob, and thank PG&E for sponsoring this webinar series. If you are interested in the 1,000 Home Challenge, send me an email. We're doing an introductory webinar on the 31st next week and then again on June 14th. We also are finalizing a compendium of resources, and some of the questions that weren't answered on the call, we got more questions we could cover. If we've got answers to them, that could be posted as just a document that goes along with the recording would be the answers to additional questions. So thank you very much for participating, and have a great day.